Welcome to the Atwell Podcast.
Awesome. Dr. Payne, it is a pleasure to have you back on. And I know our first attempt was a little wonky. So you agreeing to come back on is wonderful. Thank you so much for that.
It's a pleasure. I love your story. I love what you're doing. I love it.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much. So I was wanting to know if, for the audience's sake, you could tell us a little bit about your background prior to writing your first book, if that's
All right.
Okay.
Well, first of all, I grew up Mennonite, all right, which is a lot like Amish. I did get kicked out, okay? My first husband was in the military, and he actually came out of West Virginia, my first husband. He was in the military, and Mennonites are pacifist.
Okay.
So, yeah, kicked out. But that's how I got, I went to a Mennonite college, Goshen College, and they required that you live in a third world country for a trimester. So I lived in Haiti down in the Caribbean for 3.5 months to study property and service. And I met a wealthy Italian aristocrat there, which was kind of my first introduction to wealth, you know. And I had grown up, I'd say, fairly middle class. My dad was extremely well educated for that time. He had a master's degree in divinity, which at that time would have been unusual. Okay, and got that in the early 50s. So the bottom line is, we were fairly middle class. We had stability, but that was my first exposure to extreme wealth. And then I met my former husband, Frank Payne, who died in 2010. But he came out of Cabin Creek, West Virginia. His family was in extreme poverty. His dad died when he was six. And so they went from $600 a month to $75 a month. So his mother, five children.
Yeah, that's pretty. It's very similar, the Cabin Creek, West Virginia. The biggest thing for me with poverty in West Virginia, because I'm from West Virginia, is that towns are cut off from one another. So you might have one town here, and then you don't have another town for 30 minutes or an hour. And that makes it hard if you lose a job in one town. It makes it really difficult to me to travel, especially in the wintertime, to another town. And the other town may not have the same exact job. It may not have even the same title or anything. So I am familiar with Cabin Creek, so I figured I would add something there.
Yeah, and that's great. And that is very true. You're very isolated. I think the geography of West Virginia, the isolation is a characteristic in poverty, the ability just to access, it limits access. And then I met his neighborhood and I couldn't understand why they lived the way they did. I mean, and probably one of the instrumental things is the role of the mother in poverty. Frank's mother was formidable. And I have to say this, probably one of the most intelligent families I've ever met. Three of his siblings have IQs over 150, a sister with a photographic memory. So I learned right away it wasn't about poverty. And his mother would sit on the front porch. You know how in high poverty neighborhoods, people walk more? She didn't sit on the front porch. And as people walk by, she'd say to me, "See so-and-so there? You know what they're going to do next?" I had no idea. And she did it. And so that's how I kind of learned there were patterns that people followed.
Yeah. One thing that I've noticed being in poverty myself, even in the same areas, is that it seems as though us in poverty, we pay more closer attention to what's going on in our environment. So for me personally, I have two sons, one of them that's 10 years old, one of them that's 12, Isaac and Noah. And something that we have to pay close attention to because of the area that we live in is drug addicts, right? We have to pay attention to who's around. If there's certain people around, we automatically know that's not a good character. You guys can't go outside and play. So that's something very common. Just paying really close attention to your surroundings.
Well, it's got some similarities and it's got some differences. One of the things you'll see around the world is that one of the gifts a survival environment gives to you, no matter where you are, It teaches you how to pay attention to nonverbals because nonverbals tell you person's intent. So if you want to survive, you've got to know that. So you talked about reading the environment. That's your reading intent. And actually, in one of my books, I talk about the autonomic nervous system, how it takes in stuff. About 99% of your reaction is the autonomic nervous system. And it reads the environment. Okay. You have every human being has about 5 trillion bits of information coming at them at any given time. Your conscious mind can only hold about 10,000 bits. So you're reading the environment subconscious. Yeah. And one of the things about your grandmother is that she can read sensory. She can read vibrational patterns that are thoughts, so she knows.
No. Well, a great grandmother. She's still living, actually, 90 years old. She still lives by herself and drives, believe that. And she's going to be on the podcast later on the broader project, but she lived through extreme poverty. I mean, there was absolutely nothing. I mean, we look at it today where I'm at, and I'm like, this is crazy because I travel a lot outside of the country, outside of my state, and I see the differences. And I just imagine like what that looked like for her. You know, she had to walk 3 miles, you know, to school, you know, out of a holler. So the things that she's seen has been pretty exciting. And to talk about that even more, so she retired at like 70 years old, probably didn't realize that we was going to go through inflation and, you know, on that same teacher's income for the next 20 years. But during that time, being on that fixed income, you know, she had to save money. At one time we had a septic blow up in the yard, and I was living with my grandmother at the time. I'm probably 17, 18 years old. And she had to save for over a year and a half to come up with $5,000 to get a new septic. So what that meant was, and I'm not kidding about this, we had a 5 gallon bucket in a shed in the backyard. Now, as you know, West Virginia, from your previous husband, there's woods here, and you might be utilizing the restroom in the woods. And you hear something, you're trying to hurry up and get back. And that was a quick trip in the winter, I tell you. But yeah, she never thought nothing about it. She would just laugh about it. She looked at extreme situations. She's like, oh, well, I didn't have a toilet until I was 30 years old. You know, this is totally normal. And I think that when it comes to some levels of poverty, that there's people that came before us that may have went through things that we may not even see to this day, you know.
I agree with that. I agree. Yeah. So she it's wonderful to have people like that in your life though. They help you think about it like life very differently. And does she have a deep faith?
Yeah, so she grew up in the church, and she basically she's never smoked, never drank, never did anything, right? And she told me a story that's kind of funny. She said that her daddy looked at her when she was a little girl and said, "If I ever catch a cigarette in your mouth, I'll make you eat it." And she told me that she believed him. Yeah. She does. She believes in God. And the thing that I admire about my grandmother is, after my dad had passed away, I go and I live with her. And at the time, I'm using recreational drugs, and I'm just this terrible teenager. I'm mad at the world. I'm blaming the world for, you know, my life. And instead of judging me, she brought me into her home, and she looked at me, and she's like, "This is just a kid that needs some help." And as I've gotten older, I've looked at people who are, you know, involved in drugs and that sort of thing. And I catch myself judging them. And then I remember to myself, My grandmother looked at me with love and compassion and empathy instead of judgment. So she's a saint, in my opinion.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference. We talk about it in another one of my books about you got to stabilize basically the autonomic nervous system before you can actually move beyond it. That would be an interesting episode. But what happened then, back to my husband, what happened then as I figured out, so I figured out how his neighborhood worked and the hidden rules in his neighborhood, right? And I'd seen a lot of those in Haiti, but didn't think much about him. And then he took a job, Frank did, in the Chicago Board of Trade. And we were thrown in with really wealthy people, okay? Oh, $500,000 a year or more, 50 million, whatever. I didn't know, again, the hidden rules of wealth, but I saw them use a lot of the same things that I had seen that aristocrat in Haiti do, okay? So I didn't think anything about it, kind of learned about it. And meanwhile, I'm in the school business. Do you know, I've worked with high poverty kids. I've worked in now in Illinois. I worked with wealthy kids. And then we moved to Houston, Texas area. And I take a job in professional development for a school district. And I have a principal come to me one summer and say, "Hey, Ruby, I'm having so many discipline problems. I don't know what to do. And I need you to come give me some training in it." I said, "Well, what's your data say?" And she said, "Well, the data doesn't help." I said, "So tell me a story, right?" So here's the story she told me, and here's the story I told her, and this is what started the book. She said, "Ruby, I got two sets of twins in the building. They got two sets of clothes. One day they wear one set, the next day they wear the other set." So I said to the mother, I'd give them $200 for clothes. So it girls came back after the holidays with the same clothes. She called a little girl in and said, "What happened?" And the little girl said, "Well, we never had a DVD player. We bought one." And I said, if I was the mother, I would have done that too. And she said, "You can't be serious." And I said, "I am, because poverty is painful. And one of the tools you spend your money on is entertainment. It takes away pain." Okay. So she's having so much trouble with it. She's just furious about it. So finally, to help her understand, I told her a story from wealth. So this is a story I told her, and I'm going to ask you the same question I asked her. I was in this woman's home on the North Shore of Chicago, and she had an income in today's dollars of somewhere around $20, $25 million a year. Okay. But the woman was bitter because she knew somebody had a yacht and she didn't. Okay. And but she had all this artwork in her home. She must have had, I don't know, stunning, somewhere between $20, $25 million worth of original art. Okay. It was just gorgeous. Okay. And I made them a co comment. I saw a piece of art. It looked like a Picasso. And I made the comment, "It looks like a Picasso." Okay. And she was furious. And she said, "It is a Picasso." If you want to insult someone in wealth, all you have to do is infer their artwork is a replica, you know? It was an original, I don't know, in today's dollars, probably at least six, seven. It was a small Picasso. $6, $7 million. So I said to the principal, question I asked her is this, and I'm going to ask it to you. If somebody gave you a $6 million Picasso, what would you do with it?
I'd absolutely sell it in a heartbeat. It's gone. It's gone.
That's what she said. I said, "Well, then you're no different from the mother. You're thinking, you know, I've lived this long without a Picasso. I bet I can live some more." And the mother's thinking, "These girls have lived this long without these clothes, new clothes. I'll bet they can live some more."
That is extremely interesting. That is thought-provoking. That is really thought-provoking.
And I just said, "It's right. You, everybody makes their decisions." See, Randy, there's a basic rule here. How you spend your time determines who you know and what you know. And basically, people are going to negotiate their environments based on how they understand what they have to do to survive. See, in middle class, or when your resources are stable, here's what people do with their time. It's what you're doing with your time right now. You go to work, okay? You get educated so you can have a better job, and you buy things that become an asset like a mortgage.
Right. Yeah,
And
sure.
you have four rules about money. I don't ask you for money, and you don't ask me.
Right.
If you borrow, you got to pay it back. Never ever quit a job until you have another one.
Yeah, sure.
And you don't tell people your salary.
Yeah.
But if you were in wealth, you got a different problem. Your problem in wealth is safety. And so you make your decisions against your connections, your financial, your social, and your political connections. And see, we talked about this last time a little bit. That's one of the hardest time things about transitioning class, going from poverty to middle class or middle class to wealth. The new people you have to meet, the social bridging capital. We talked about that last time. And the bottom line on it is, in wealth, so one of the hidden rules in wealth is, you don't talk about the cost of an item. Never ask what something costs. And then, as you know, in poverty, you share your money and you spend your time against survival, relationships, because people keep you alive, and entertainment.
My mother, like I said, she dealt with Social Security disability pretty much her whole life. She's never had a job, like an employment job. But at the end of the month, even in my early adulthood, like I said, she would $700, $800, $1,000, whatever it is now. She's probably got a couple raises, but she would at the end of the month have $23. I've never seen anybody manage money like my mother. With no education, she manages money to the penny. And she will save $5 to $7 a month to buy Christmas. Or at the end of the month, she would call me. She said, "Randy, I have some toilet paper here for you to pick up." And it's so embarrassing. It's like, "Mom, I got like $3 or $4. I can run to the dollar store and get some toilet paper. I can go and get my own stuff." She didn't understand, and probably still doesn't to this day, that I have my own money and I have a job. I don't need you to buy me paper towels or something simple. But it's the things that she does to try to be nice. And I really appreciate that. But I try to tell her, I was like, "Mom, save your money." And I've bought her shoes and things like that. But the way that people have to budget their money in poverty, I think, and it directly correlates to education, because the biggest thing I've seen with people that are in poverty is they don't know how to manage, and they maybe don't have the education to manage. So I have friends that could potentially save $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a year, but they just see it as such a hurdle that they don't even try. They're just like, whatever, I'll just go to Applebee's. It's like, okay, well, it looks like to me you're struggling pretty hard. You need to save some money. You have $0 in your electric bills due, but you're at Applebee's. It's not making sense to me,
Well, it's because you're doing it for a form of entertainment. Part One of the things that permeates generational poverty is a belief in fate and luck. People will say things like, "Well, he's no good just like his daddy," or, "I never was any good in school and he won't be either." Or like one of the girls in Frank's neighborhood was having sex with her boyfriend in high school, and I said, "Don't you think you ought to use a contraceptive?" And she said, "You know, Ruby, if God wants me to get pregnant, I will." Well, evidently he was for it, okay, because she did. But it's that concept that, I just had bad luck. Let me tell you one more story and you'll get it. But Frank had two brothers in and out of jail all his life, okay? And and I should say that there's only out of five siblings, there's only one that's still alive. Okay. So you die young in poverty. Okay. You die younger. But he had a brother who he got put in jail for drinking and driving. Okay. And he called me one day and I thought he was still in jail because he used to have us pick him up. And I said, "Where are you?" He said, "Ruby, I'm in jail." He said, "I just got me out of jail." And he said, "You know what? Randy got, not Randy, was a guy, I believe the guy's name was Randy. He said he got me a brand new Kawasaki motorcycle for $100. Well, I know that's a hot motorcycle, right? Stolen.
Yes.
But I still want to know where he is. I said, so where are you? And he said, well, I live on Main Street with Tony. No, it was Tony. It wasn't Randy. So I said, okay. And so the bottom line, I said, he said, well, you know, I took that motorcycle out. It'll go 100 miles an hour. Then I realized he was drunk. Okay. I said, hey, you just got out of jail and you nearly killed somebody for drinking and driving and you're doing it again. I mean, I couldn't help myself. He said, Ruby, I just had bad luck. I said, bad luck? You were drunk.
Yeah, bad choices.
And this is what he said. I said, you were probably drunk every night for months. He said, I was, Ruby. I just had bad luck one night. He said, if I wouldn't have been on the road when the cop was on the road, I never got caught. And so it's this kind of fate and luck business. And so if you believe that, then it's much harder for you to act on your own behalf.
So throughout my life, honestly, the fate and luck thing really hits home with me, and it kind of puts me on my toes a little bit because throughout my life I've went through crazy things that, like, okay, let's just take the first thing by thing. So, well, I've been through two house fires. Well, the reality of it are there electrical fires when you don't have any money, you're in a bad infrastructure, you're not renting the best place, you're not in a nice apartment or condo, you're in the cheapest of the cheap because that's what you can afford. So there could be infrastructural deals. Another thing is when you're buying $20 hair dryers from Walmart and you use them for 3 straight years, they're liable to break. That could lead to it. So you the items that you're using don't have as good of safety regulations, or I don't know really how to word it, but you understand what I'm trying to get at here. You're using terrible items, you have terrible infrastructure, so that could definitely help raise the chances of house fires. My wife, before we ever even got together, she has been through two house fires. I've been through two house fires. Extreme poverty people here in West Virginia, it's almost fun to have a house fire because you get a couple thousand dollars from the church. And you get to start over. You're like, oh, great. I get all new stuff now. This is wonderful. This is almost better than what it was before. So, that.
Well, we work on Native American Indian reservations, and we're working on one in South Dakota right now. House fires are huge, and they'll have 20, 30 people living in one house, and it takes the fire department 45 minutes to get there. So by the time they get there's nothing left.
Yeah. Well, here we live in a lot of trailers. So trailers are very common to just go up in 20 minutes. This is honest to God a true story. We lived in a trailer in Monroe County, West Virginia. So Monroe County doesn't even have a red light. They don't have the whole county, no red light, no fast food restaurant. The grocery store for the entire county, one, is smaller than a Family Dollar store. So, anyways, we lived so far out. There's a place called Gatman. It was probably an hour from the closest fire department. And I'll never forget this as a kid. My parents took us to the grocery store. We had to go to Greenbrier County to go to a regular grocery store. It must have been close to the first of the month. And by the time we got back, there was nothing but yellow tape and rubble and a chimney. That was it. So, in that time that we left to go grocery shopping and come back home, not only was the whole house gone, but there's no fire department, there's no police, there's nobody even there. They've already left. They're like, well, this is gone. We don't, the fire's out, we're leaving, So we just like leave, go grocery shopping, come back. Poof, everything, your whole life's gone. And I was too young to really remember what my parents what their discussions was, but ironically enough, I do remember that there being a Bible on the front dash of my dad's Buick, and how that relates to fate is when you go through so many of these things. For me, I used to think I was cursed. I used to honestly, to God, think that there was some kind of curse in my life. But it's really, Randy, you're not cursed. You're just extremely poor, and your circumstances and your environment are putting you at a higher risk for these terrible things that can happen to anybody, you know.
That's true. And they put you at higher risk for early death, particularly if you're male. Okay. Stats are that if you come out of poverty, you die on the average. If you don't get out, okay, of poverty, you die on the average 10 years younger than your peers. And you can see it because of what you were talking about, all the circumstances, all the pieces that happen.
And drugs play into that a huge bit, I think, because I lived in sixth grade, I lived in a little place called Alderson, West Virginia, which my sixth grade class had about 10 people. And four people on my block at my age, I'm 33, so four people have already died in a town that maybe had 5,000.
Right.
And most of them from drug-related issues or suicide. So.
Well, and it becomes what drugs do is when we get to this in another session, what drugs do is they put you down in the lowest level of the autonomic nervous system, the hierarchy. And what it is a soothing mechanism for your autonomic nervous system.
I wanted to ask you about your time as a Mennonite. So I know about the Amish, and maybe there's no correlation here, but can you tell me like what life was like living Mennonite?
Well, let me just say that, let me back it up and so the frame of it. When Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the Catholic Church in the 1400s and said, hey, around 1495, I don't agree with the Catholic Church anymore. I don't believe you have to talk to a priest to talk to God, okay? He was a Catholic priest. He broke off, and that led the Protestant Revolution. Okay. Well, there was another Catholic priest at that time whose name was Menno Simons, who thought Martin Luther didn't go far enough. He thought that you should, Martin Luther kept infant baptism. He thought you should not be baptized till you were the age of consent. So, what that did is that started the Mennonite religion. And they became known in Europe as Anti-Baptists. Okay. And they were persecuted. So a lot of them fled to the United States in the 1700s, early 1800s, like that. And most of them came from agrarian areas, okay? And they settled in the United States. And around 1800, right around in that time frame, there was a one of the Mennonites that came over was a guy named Jacob Amond. And he started the Amish. And he thought that the Mennonites didn't go far enough that they should not accept anything new in their lives. So Amish women still wear the German nursing dress from 1800s, no zippers, no buttons, no running water, no electricity. Do you know what I mean? All of that. Okay. No cars. So Mennonites didn't do that. They kept, progressing, but both groups are pacifist. Okay. But between the two groups, there's a lot of difference, okay? In theology and practice, for example, Amish can't read their Bibles and haven't been able to for the last 200 years.
Really?
No, because the Bibles are written in German, High German, and they only speak Dutch or English. And so the Bible stories among Amish have been passed word of mouth for the last 200 years. So there's a discrepancy in between the written text and the stories that are told. But one of the things that's fascinating is Mennonites and Amish tend to live in the same communities, because what happens is that Mennonites become kind of the bridge by which Amish interface in their communities. So, yeah.
So Mennonites, so they're hopefully I'm understanding this correctly. So Mennonites compared to Amish, Mennonites are still allowed to use like modern infrastructure, I guess you could say.
And
So
they're allowed
when you were
to be
growing,
educated. They're allowed to be educated. Amish are not. Amish are not allowed to go past the eighth grade.
no. That's wild. And I never would have believed, like, I never would have even thought about the Bible thing. And that's, I know I'm going to butcher this, but I watched a documentary one time on how the King James Version Bible came into place. And how it explained it is there was two different sects. What was it? I can't remember, but one of the sects basically that only the priest was allowed to, or the pastor, however you say, was allowed to read the Bible. Nobody else was allowed to read it, just him. And then the other one, the Bible was available, but it had basically an interpretation of all the verses written directly beside the verse. So it didn't leave any, it was basically telling you what to read into a verse. So if you're looking at John 3:16, it may have an annotation there that says, this is what this actually means, which obviously is kind of dangerous because what it could do is it would be up to the leaders of the church whether or not to manipulate the understanding.
Well, see, part of the problem was that the Bible was in Latin and Greek. The Catholic Church had it in Latin, Greek. And so one of the things that Luther did is he actually translated then the Bible into German, okay? And then the printing press came along about that time and so made it more widely available. But the thing of it is that in practice, there's a huge Mennonites as a group are losing members, okay? But Amish as a group are gaining members. Amish have big families, and they have 8 to 10 children, and they are actually gaining membership. Yes.
Yeah, so when so my thoughts before this was, so I thought Mennonites and Amish was basically the same thing. That just, so when you were talking about your background getting brought up, I was thinking, well, she my mind is Dr. Ruby Payne in a sundress in a field churning butter and
Well, you
making
wouldn't be
log
far
cabins.
wrong about that. Okay, you would not be far wrong about that because you weren't when I grew up, you were not allowed to. I never got to go to a sports game until I was a junior in high school. Okay, no dancing. Dancing was having sex in public. Okay, no slacks. No, I mean, yes, I mean it was. It was very strict. No movies. No, I got to see one movie in high school. That was it, The Sound of Music. I mean, there was just, I went to public schools, but I was not allowed to participate in the extracurricular activities. Okay. So you, it was work, 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 work. And I was the oldest of six. So I did then go to a year of private Mennonite high school in Virginia. And then I went to Mennonite colleges. Yeah.
It sounds like you moved around a lot, like not just like locally. For me, we moved pretty much every year of my childhood, but all within the same area. But it sounds like to me, like I've done heard Virginia and Texas, and I think you're living in California now, maybe,
Oh,
or
Texas.
oh, you're in Texas?
So I'm in Texas. Here's I lived in Ohio. Well, I was born in Indiana, lived in Ohio. Then I lived in Katy. Then I lived in Indiana. Then I lived in Corpus Christi, Texas. Then Chicago, Illinois. Then Houston. Now back in Corpus Christi, Texas.
Yeah. So it's like with that travel, I haven't lived in that many places. I don't have nearly the years of life experience. But one thing I've noticed with traveling internationally, I'm going to Egypt in April, and one of the things I've noticed is that you really, once you get out of that bubble, then you start gaining a broader picture of life. And with the different social classes and then the amount of different areas you were in, even internationally, it just seems like that it really helped you to paint a broader picture of the hidden rules, I guess you could say, because you were looking at many different examples, but finding the same correlations across.
Yeah, you're seeing the same things over and over again. Like wealthy community in the world Because since I wrote the book, now I've been to Australia 7 times to work, New Zealand, Malaysia, Europe, China, many parts of the world. And the thing is, the wealthy around the world, that top 1%, they're more liked than any other group of people for this reason. They travel internationally, they live internationally, they speak multiple languages, they associate in the, a lot of times their children go to the same private boarding schools around the world, Switzerland, Europe. And so they have the same issues. And one of the biggest issues wealthy people have is just safety, personal safety. Okay. Like Elon Musk has a, his security force is bigger than the president's. So one of the things you look at is just how you begin to negotiate that environment. And poverty around the world is pretty universal in this way. The closer you get to survival, the more the rules are the same. Okay. And like we talked last time, it all boils down to food.
Food. I'll tell you, when it comes to food, what I noticed from my firsthand point of view hasn't really, I can't really honestly, I thought about this before we even did this morning. I can't even think of an exception to this personally. Just about everybody I know has either lived on food stamps or is on food stamps now. And the big thing that keeps happening when it comes to food is in the first or third of the month, depending on your last name, some people even get it on the sixth, they have a whole refrigerator full. Everything's full. Well, at the end of the month, they're all scrounging. Nobody has anything. And I guess I've come to the conclusion or the theory, I guess you could say, that when it comes to poverty and food quantity, the quality is not going to be there because you can't afford it. So quality is out the door. But as far as a quantity perspective, it's more a budgeting problem than it is a access problem. Because, and I'm not talking about people who are homeless. That's like total desolation. I'm talking like a level above that. People who at least have some low income housing, they're on food stamps. If they have kids, they're probably better off in my perspective, because the more kids that you have, the more access to public
Assistant.
assistance. So yeah, it's like a budgeting problem, which I would almost correlate to an education problem, because it's like, it's like, okay, well, don't buy the name brand Apple Jacks, buy the off brand, save $2. That's always been my thought, but it doesn't happen like that.
Well, see, one of the rules about food that I talk about in the book is in poverty is quantity. And the question after meals, did you like it? Was it the question after meal is, are you full? Did you have enough? Middle class, it's about quality. Did you like it? Was it good? Okay. Well, it's about presentation. Was it artistically presented? And what you and was it aesthetically prepared? But the issue about in poverty is that one of the ways people in poverty indulge themselves is brand name food. Okay. In other words, my mother-in-law was very particular about what kind of sausage she bought. It had to be Jimmy Dean and nothing else. Do you know? No generic sausage. Okay. And just that whole concept of certain brands were better than others, and we will spend our money on that, even if there's a less expensive alternative. And it is that whole concept of you in that's a way you indulge yourself.
Well, I think, and then as it relates to like food stamp recipients, if you've been without food for the last week of the month because you didn't manage well, then when you go to that grocery store on the first of the month, you're overbuying for what you actually need because you've been without and you're going in there hungry. There's a saying that might be a South saying or a poverty saying, it's never go to the grocery store on an empty stomach. Because you'll spend way more, so
But the other reason I'll spend everything on there when they get their food stamps or food deposit is that if you don't, you have to share. And see, that's problematic. You know, if you want Uncle Ray to help you with your car And he calls you and says, hey, can you help me with, you got any food? Can you share? Do you know what I mean? One of the understandings is you've got to, it's kind of a negotiation deal there. And I think that, and there's, as you well know, there's some things you can't buy with food stamps. Okay. So that means you got to trade off some of that. You got to do some bartering. You can't buy paper. You can't buy anything that you can't put in your mouth, chew, and swallow. So the bottom line is that's feminine products. It's so many other things you can't buy.
And with to your point on the sharing part, one thing that I've definitely noticed on the sharing part is that you buy stuff specifically for you. This is mine. Nobody else. Like in poverty, one of the things I've noticed is like instead of buying one or two cereals, they buy three or four cereals. These are my Apple Jacks. Don't touch them. These are my Captain Crunch. Don't touch it. So, I've definitely noticed that.
Yes. Back to your comment about children, the more children you have, the more assistance you get. There's a book out there right now, Poorly Understood, What Americans Don't Get About Poverty. Okay. And the professor, who obviously has never had any experience in the real world of poverty, he's just studied numbers. But he's got a chapter in there that it's absolutely a myth that a woman will have more children because she can have more money, more support. So it's a myth because if she does the math, it doesn't work out for her. And I'm thinking, no, you got to understand, that's not how you think about it. You don't think about the math, you're thinking about how can I get more assistance?
I agree with you 100%. I totally disagree with his statement. And from a firsthand point of view, I know people right now who have had more children because of the earned income tax credits.
Exactly. And he's saying that's not true. That's a myth. It never happens. And I'm going, where are you, buddy?
Usually I don't fight back on things like that so much, but yeah, he's 100% wrong. And even from not only the people that I know right now, but even early in my 20s when I first had children, I'll tell you how it happened for me. This was a aha moment, and it's probably one of the reasons why I'm where I'm at because I knew how to budget. I saw my friends, they would get their tax refund, they'd go to the strip club. Me, I'm like, I've been struggling to pay rent. I'm paying my rent. What are you doing? But anyways, so this is how it happened for me. My wife had my first son on December the 27th of 2012. And I had been working at a restaurant. And of course, the year rolls around and I do our taxes, Well, my aunt had done our taxes. And she calls me and she says, Randy, she says, you want to know how much you're getting back in taxes? And I said, I have no idea. Keep in mind my financial situation at the time. My monthly rent was $300. Every 2 weeks, I got a check for $400. So basically, one of my checks were totally gone between my rent and my water bill, which means I had to pay for my car, my electric, any goods that I needed, paper goods, whatever for the house, off of $400 a month with a child, an infant child, diapers, everything. My wife, stay-at-home wife at the time. So she calls me and she says, do you know how much you're going to get back this year? And I was like, how much? She said, $7,000. I said, I mean, my jaw almost hit the floor when she said $7,000 because I had never had that much money in my life. There was no hope of me ever getting that much money in my life. And I kept thinking, I'm going to go to prison. She has done my taxes wrong. I was so shocked. At the time, I was maybe making, I don't know, you could figure it up. Whatever $400 is every 2 weeks, I guess it would be 500 before taxes were taken out. So however much that is a year. I was working at Little Caesars at the time. And so whenever I got my tax money in, once that money hit the bank account, I'm like, I'm not going to prison. The very first thing I did, and I did this for every single year after, I paid my rent up for a whole year. And my friends thought that I was a genius, but they never would follow me on it. And I kept on beating it into their head. I'm like, guys, you've got to pay up your. And I still do this to this day. where the biggest bill I have, whatever that bill is, whether it's a car payment, I own my house now, I don't pay a mortgage or anything. So my biggest payment is like a car payment. I like to pay my bill up for a year because to me, if you're struggling or if you get into a situation in life where you are struggling, it's a lot easier to come up with $80 than it is $400 if you don't have that money. It's not the case for me anymore. I'm a lot more stable. But as to your point with that guy previously, he is 100% wrong. I think it maxes out. I can almost tell you, I think the earned income tax credit at $39,000, you start losing money off your taxes. So nobody wants to work a real job to get over 39,000 because they're going to get $10,000 to $12,000 in tax return on two, three kids. People have children. 100% in my area, I've seen people have children specifically to get more food stamps, specifically, even more so, the earned income tax credit.
And the thing about it is that on the Native American Indian tribe we're on right now, and it's not, I'm sure you see it in your neighborhood, is they get that earned income tax credit and they immediately go out and buy a brand new car, pickup or whatever, okay? And then 6 months later, they got to give it back. It gets repossessed because they can't continue to pay for it, okay? But it's that whole concept, I think, that yeah, well, the other thing about that guy that wrote the book Poorly Understood What Americans Get Wrong, he misspelled my name. Okay.
Oh, no.
Yeah, he talks about me like I'm a dog, basically kind of denigrates me and misspelled my name. And I thought, well, buddy, you've really lost credibility with me because it's obviously a reality that you don't understand and it's not a myth. Okay.
No, he and I don't know what his background was growing
He's a
up or whatever.
professor. Oh, yeah.
Do you know if he grew up in poverty or middle class or?
He probably grew up in middle class. If he didn't, he wouldn't. If he grew up in poverty, he'd understand that
Yeah,
difficulty.
100%. That's the point that I was gonna make. He's absolutely crazy. But even to add to your point, you are 100% right. It may not be for cars. For here, basically, people will buy, and I got sucked into this trap. So I told you I had $7,000. I paid my rent up, which was $3,600 for the year, and it would get me to the next tax year. So now my paychecks are freed up, but I still didn't have any credit. Now, part of that, I will be fair, part of that was because I didn't have any parents to teach me about loans and things like that. Obviously, I learned over the years, but the thing of it was, is I would buy beaters, what we call beaters, $2,000 cars that wasn't going to last the year. They mostly just blow up, right? But I've seen not the car situation, but I've seen people go to Rent-A-Center and they will buy a whole living room suit, a whole bedroom suit, $2,000 to $3,000. They'll pay. It's like $50, a week for the next 37 years. It's a
The rent to own is horrible. Oh, it's
yeah.
horrible.
It's so predatory on people that are uneducated and they don't really know how to look at the numbers,
Exactly.
and they don't
Exactly.
do. And but yeah, I have a friend who I won't say his name because I don't have permission, but I have a friend who grew up extremely impoverished, maybe more impoverished than me. And he tells me stories about the Rent-A-Center thing. He says that there was times that he would come home and the entire house is empty
Yeah.
because they've done come and repoed all the furniture.